Support for WPR comes from The Alliance, committed to being an objective partner for over 425 employers and their brokers, providing self-funded employers with data to manage their health plans. The-Alliance.org.
We'll talk with the author of The Vanishing Neighbor, The Transformation of American Community, about why Americans are more polarized than ever before, how this happened and why, and what it means for our future. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we will wonder if you agree. And we will wonder, do you talk to your neighbors? Are you friends with your neighbors? How about, are you friends with anyone who has opposing political views? How about on Facebook or other social media sites? Do you associate with people who don't share your political views? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Mark Dunkelman, a research fellow at Brown University's Taubman Center for Public Policy and American Institutions. He's also a senior fellow at the Clinton Foundation, and his writing has appeared in the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, Politico, and National Affairs, among others. He is the author of The Vanishing Neighbor, The Transformation of American Community. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
What do you mean by the vanishing neighbor?
Well, Joy, several years ago, I began to compare the community that I had growing up in Buffalo, New York, to the community that my father had growing up in Cincinnati, Ohio. And what I noticed was that when we drove down the street where he grew up when I was a kid, he could point at each house and tell me who lived there, what the parents had done, where the kids went to college, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And when I was in fourth grade and had lived in Buffalo several years and got a paper route, most of the names on the roster on my own street were strangers. They were people that I wouldn't even have recognized if I passed them in the grocery store. And what I discovered was that it's not that community is disappearing in America, and that's frequently what people say, is that we're bowling alone or we don't join communal institutions anymore. The truth is we're more connected than ever, but we're connected to different sorts of people. We're connected even more tightly with the people who are most intimate with us, our spouses, our children, our parents, our best friends. We're also connected much more intimately or much more regularly with people who we only have a single connection with. We both crochet. We both root for the Packers. We both, whatever it is. And what's happened is that those relationships that are in between, that are familiar but not intimate, people that we know through several aspects of our life, who would know a bunch about us, where we went to school, how many kids we have, if our son is struggling in algebra, if our spouse just lost her job, whatever it is, those relationships, which are a very specific type, have withered.
Yeah. Well, you know, everybody in Wisconsin, just about everybody in Wisconsin, cheers for the Packers. So that's the one area where we might not be so polarized. But how has the changing of the American community, how has this led to us being more polarized than ever before?
Yeah, I think that we've got a little bit of confusion about why we're polarized. And the tendency we have is to look at Washington, and we go through a very familiar litany of complaints. There's too much money in politics. Districts have been gerrymandered. The filibuster is out of control. Lobbyists have taken over. These are all things that we often cite and are certainly contributing factors. The funny thing is that if you go through that litany, each of those phenomena existed before things got so rough in Washington, right? I mean, gerrymandering is named after Elbridge Gerry, who was James Madison's vice president. I mean, there have been crazy districts in America forever. There have been special interests forever. Lobbying, this may be apocryphal, but the word on the street in Washington is that the term lobbyist comes from the administration of Ulysses Grant, who would sit in the lobby of the Willard Hotel and wait for people to come up and ask for special favors. I think that the reason that things are so polarized in Washington and in the United States is that those neighborly relationships between people who are familiar but not intimate were the places where people saw and knew folks who had opposing points of view, and they actually had an interchange with them. And so even if they didn't agree on whether the social safety net should be expanded or government was the root of all evil or whatever their neighbor's point of view was, they thought, you know, I don't agree, but it's not crazy. I understand why they're saying that. I understand what it is that they're getting at. And so we may not agree, but I bet in most cases we can work things out. In the absence of those middle ring, that's what I call them in my book, middle ring relationships, neighborly relationships, and in the absence of that element of familiarity, it's much harder to stomach the idea that your member of Congress or your state assemblyman or your president would reach out and compromise with people who hold a different view. And so really the issue is that we are sending to Washington people who have a mandate not to compromise. And that is the root of the polarization in Washington and the gridlock.
Yeah, talk a little bit more about the rings. You use the analogy of Saturn's rings to describe our relationships.
Yeah, so this is right at the core of my book. If you think about where you individually invest your time and attention, and you put all of your friends in a framework that looks like the rings of Saturn, and you put your most intimate contacts, your spouse or your kids or your parents or your best friend, right in the inner rings, and you put the people who are the least intimate, so the barista you had at Starbucks this morning, in the outermost ring, and you organize every person you know along that spectrum, from the most to the least intimate, my argument is that for the first time in American history, over the course of the last several decades, we've taken much more of our time and attention and invested it in the innermost rings, so those most intimate contacts. So, for example, I'm actually out of town. I'm not living. I spent the night in New York. My family's in Providence, Rhode Island. Mm-hmm. I've already been in touch three times with my wife this morning.
Mm-hmm.
So those ties, I'm spending much more time and attention on those most intimate ties. I'm spending much more time talking to people in the outer rings. So these are the people that are, I either agree with them on a political issue or I root for the same football team, or whatever it is. These are issues that I don't necessarily even know who they are. I'm just in contact with them about a single issue. They are taking up much more of our time. And what's happened is those inner and outer rings have sapped the time and attention that we tend to spend on those middle neighborly rings.
And because I'm not, I don't know, chatting it up with my neighbors, and I'm not. because of that, we're more polarized. I'm trying to figure out if I talk to my neighbors more, how that would make us less polarized.
Yeah. So what I think is that it was through those neighborly relationships that you yourself began to understand what people who had different opinions were thinking. It made you familiar with the conservative who lives next door, or the liberal who lives next door, or the Bears fan who lives across the street, or whatever it is. You begin to notice, you know, there's a small business across the street. You're an academic. she's a small business person, you start talking about taxes. Just in the course of conversation, you're borrowing a cup of sugar, whatever it is, you begin to see that her point of view on government fiscal matters may not be the one that you embrace. It may not be your point of view, but it's not crazy. And so it seems much more reasonable to you that you could work out that a member of Congress or a member of the state legislature who did a deal with the people that represent her interests, that's a reasonable point of view to have. You wouldn't be outraged. It would seem like the rational thing to do, rather than the person who compromised or reached across the aisle otherwise seems like they are doing something that is completely antithetical to what you yourself believe. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think about back in, you know, when I was growing up, my parents, for example, they might be in debates with neighbors that were friends of theirs to some extent over politics, but it didn't come to blows. It was, yeah, they disagreed over who they wanted to vote for, you know, for president or something, but they still went fishing after work or whatever. But now, if there are different political signs in front of neighbors' lawns, they're not speaking to each other.
I think that's exactly right, and I think that's exactly the issue: is that people come home, they pull into their driveway, they close the garage door, they have long conversations with their kids or their spouses, they get online, they talk to people who agree with them there. And so the conversation that they would have had across the driveway or across the street or while waiting for their turn to bowl in a bowling league, that in the absence of those conversations, it's really very difficult to have an experience where you meet someone who holds a different point of view and you say, oh, well, maybe I don't agree, but I understand where they're coming from.
Yeah.
There's also sort of this interesting development that's happened over the last few decades where the definition of the word neighborly has changed. You know, 50 years ago, neighborly meant engaging with your neighbors, right? It meant when somebody moved in, you brought over a plate of cookies, or you asked how they were, or you looked after the kids if someone had to stay late at work. Today, in many cases, neighborly means leaving people alone. So that even if you hear an argument through the wall or you see something happen, you pretend it didn't happen, because to be neighborly is to let people have their privacy. It's a big change. And in the absence of those connections, it's much harder to stomach the compromise that was once sort of the staple of American politics.
We'll talk a little bit more about how this happened and what it means and where it's going with Mark Dunkelman, author of The Vanishing Neighbor, The Transformation of American Community. And we'll welcome your questions for him and any observations you might have. Does this sound like your neighborhood? Does this sound like your Facebook page? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Are you friendly with your neighbors or acquaintances who have opposing political viewpoints? Or do you not talk to your neighbors at all? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We are talking with the author of The Vanishing Neighbor, The Transformation of American Community, and how that has affected our politics and our relationships, leading to a more polarization than ever before. So we're talking about how and why this happened and what the future might bring, and we're welcoming your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Mark, we have a lot of comments on our Facebook page pointing to media outlets like Fox or MSNBC or conservative talk radio as the cause of our polarization. Does the media play a role in this at all?
I think undoubtedly. There's an element to be played by the media. The funny thing is, of course, there was a brief period in American history, I like to call it the Cronkite era, where news was created by what were meant to be nonpartisan, apolitical organizations. And that's the way that many of the Americans alive today grew up, getting their news from those sources. And since then, it is undoubtedly true that we have much more partisan news-making organizations. And that's true of Fox and MSNBC and conservative talk radio. The issue, the curious thing is, through most of American history, we've always had very partisan media, right? I mean, if you looked at the number of newspapers and magazines published in the 1800s and the early 1900s, those were largely partisan newspapers. And the question is, what's happened now that's different? Now, it's undoubtedly true that having people get their news from sources that clearly are pushing an agenda, that's playing a role. The issue is, what is it that's making it so that even when they hear whatever they're being told by a talking head or by a radio host, they're able to understand or appreciate the opposing view? And in my mind, my argument is that sense of mutual understanding happened in these conversations that happened in the Rotary Club and across the driveway and in the PTA and in all of these middle ring relationships where you were meeting people who had different points of view. And even if you didn't agree, you began to appreciate where they were coming from.
Yeah. Or you were at least civil.
Yep.
Yeah. Because you wanted to borrow a cup of sugar, maybe. Bob on Facebook says, my neighbors would let their kids run around the neighborhood, and they were always in our yard playing. We bought Girl Scout cookies every time they came around. We always said hi and were very nice to them and their kids. Once they found out during the last presidential election that we leaned to the left, they stopped talking to us, and their kids no longer play in our yard, and they pass by our house come Girl Scout cookie time. They outright shun us now. Gosh, what do you make of that?
Well, one, I feel terrible that he's not getting his Girl Scout cookies. That's important. But two, I mean, I think that is the sad state of affairs, and what you hope is that in more cases and in other cases, people who learn that the people across the street have a different point of view politically still continue to engage. And I think in many cases they do. The issue is when they don't even have that relationship to begin, when they move into a neighborhood and no one ever says hi, or when they get home from work in the evening, they drive into their driveway, close the garage door, and never engage. And frankly, I'll tell you that in my experience, which is a little bit different, I just moved my family from an apartment in the District of Columbia to Providence, Rhode Island, explicitly because I was looking for these middle ring relationships. I wanted to be in a community where I knew people would talk to each other. And the truth is, not everybody along the street where I live has the same point of view. But we continue to talk, and we tease each other about our political points of view, and we root for different football teams, and we have different interests. But the hope is that in many more cases, people do have these connections, and even when they find out that they disagree about this or about that, the fact that they are neighbors and they want to remain friendly and they depend on one another for that cup of sugar is reason for them to believe that when it comes to politics or whatever the issue, it's worth trying to find some sort of mutual accommodation.
Let's go to the phones. Dave in Menominee is with us. Hi, Dave.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to bring up how the cities are being planned out and built, actually. The neighborhood we live in was put together in the late 1800s. Our houses are very close, just 10 feet apart. And we know all our neighbors. But the newer parts of the city are not like that. They're cul-de-sacs. They're long, winding roads that do not have intersections, no corners on any blocks. There are no blocks. And the houses and the yards are designed in a way where you really don't have to see your neighbor. There's a curve. They are specifically set up where you kind of don't have to see anybody. And I wanted to bring up the polarization that happened, especially in Wisconsin, after Governor Walker was elected. You know, we had just won the Super Bowl. The Packers just won the Super Bowl. It was great. And then Governor Walker, you know, quote unquote, dropped the bomb. And I can tell you, 2 weeks after that, we had even forgotten that we won the Super Bowl. It was like a rubber band being stretched in one direction, and the confusion and the conflicts have not stopped. It just the right has lurched so far to the right that the people in the center are no longer in the center. The center is being moved by this lurch to the right. And remember, the Republicans got rid of all their moderates. They challenged them all. They're primarying them all, and they're challenging any of them that would be in any kind of moderate talk.
Yeah. Dave, thanks, because we had two big areas here to address, but I wanted to first go to the first point, Mark, if you can, that our neighborhoods today are designed differently than they used to be, and we don't see our neighbors because of the way they space the house or urban sprawl, or that's part of why we don't know our neighbors.
Joy, it's a really important point, and it's actually the point that I make when people say, "Well, isn't this just social media? Isn't this just the internet? Isn't that the effect of of the fact that we're connecting to people through Twitter?" In fact, I think that all this shift away from middle ring relationships predates all of that and begins really with the post-war era, where we begin to move out into the suburbs. Because the suburbs, are really certainly the exurbs and newer suburbs, exactly as the caller described them. They are built so that people don't talk to one another. That's exactly right. And whether that was explicitly by design or not, that has been the effect. So I think that what's so interesting is that this concept, Tocqueville talked about it in the 1830s, of a township. And this is sort of, I like to think of it as sort of like Little House on the Prairie, where you have this sort of this village of people who are all, wherever they come from, whether doctors or lawyers or plumbers or they stay at home or whatever it is, they're all connecting through different points of their lives and through different points of the day, whether it's in the park, at the restaurant, at work, whatever it is, they're all mutually dependent and they're all familiar with one another. And it's something that Tocqueville said really distinguished the United States from societies in Europe, where people were oriented by class or by background, and that this sort of this unique orientation of townships really begin with colonial villages. They last through frontier towns. They are reconstituted in urban tenements. They exist really in the first-ring suburbs. But as we move on, for the first time in American history, over the course of the last few decades, that township model of organizing your community has been eviscerated because we've lost these middle ring connections. And some of that is absolutely related back to just urban design. But it's a whole confluence of reasons that have brought about this fairly dramatic effect.
Yeah. And I don't know how intimately familiar you are with what happened in Wisconsin over the past few years, but Dave kind of described it. Everybody was cheering the Packers Super Bowl win. We had a new governor then who proposed something that led to massive protests at our Capitol, hundreds of thousands of people showing up. A lot of people said it pitted neighbor against neighbor. We just had a caller who dropped off, who couldn't stand the line, who was going to talk about how she felt she had to defend her job as a school teacher during this whole Act 10 controversy in Wisconsin that took away collective bargaining rights and other things. And that made it very hard to be neighborly. So I think Dave was saying, though, it was conservative ideology and the move to the right politically that has caused the polarization, not the loss of the middle rings and our relationships with our neighbors. How can you respond to that?
Well, I mean, I think we've got a chicken and an egg problem here. And it's a little hard to decipher exactly what comes before what. My sense is that if you know fairly well a neighbor who is a public school teacher and who does a great job, or you know somebody who would really be affected by a change in public policy, the tendency is, even if you think that we need to make that change, or even if you have a different political point of view, you understand where you're coming, where they're coming from, and you're more likely want to find some way to compromise. If by chance you don't know those people, they're just people you see on the news, or you hear about on the radio, or you read about in the paper. You don't have an experience with them. You haven't actually spoken to them. You haven't had a cup of coffee or a conversation about the Packers with them. It's much easier to say, oh, no, that's crazy. And the question is, what is the mechanism that got Americans to be unusually invested in finding ways to work together? In my view, the only thing that's changed, the only thing, that's too strong, the major change that's happened over the course of the last few decades is we've lost these familiar townshiped middle ring relationships. And that's where the root of township community came from, and that was why, through all the divisive issues that have divided Americans politically through two centuries now, we've always found a way to come back together and find ways to accommodate one another in the end, divisive as it was along the way.
Let's go back to the phones. Kendra in Milwaukee is with us. Hello, Kendra.
Hi there. Good morning.
Morning.
One of the comments I wanted to make is in my neighborhood on the east side, for a long time we had a block garage sale every year, and we still have our winter progressive dinner. And these things are the things at which I've had the largest opportunity to speak with people, and I think it's a great thing. My other point is that I think that the pundits on the opposite side of the aisle have done such a good job of insulting me that it really makes my brain just want to shut down when alternate points of view come across. So that was just another comment I wanted to make. You know, we become defensive, kind of.
And I just wanted to make sure I understood that comment, Kendra. So when you hear someone with an opposite point of political point of view as you, you think that they're like attacking you or not being, your brain shuts down because
it's the media. The media have done that. I think they have successfully wound up people to such a pitch that we just don't want to hear it anymore. You know, I don't want to hear that I'm not a patriot because I oppose a war or, you know, anything like that. And I think that's where my initial offense came from at people across the aisle. Like, just because I want to go to war, that doesn't mean I'm not a patriot.
Yeah. But your neighborhood, you're saying that your neighborhood you know your neighbors, you socialize with your neighbors, you have these garage sales and dinner parties.
Yes. Yeah.
And is everybody of the same political point of view that's participating in these things? And
we don't bring politics into it, but I know that there are people who are independent business people. I know that there are people who are teachers. And through one of my neighbors, I learned a great deal about, you know, how hard it is to be a teacher.
Yeah. Well, so I guess Kendra's saying not all neighborhoods have, you know, have disintegrated. She's got a, she knows her neighbors, yet, you know, the world is still polarized, Mark.
Yeah, I think I think that's absolutely true, that there are certain neighborhoods in America that have maintained these middle rings. I mean, in just in the same way that when we went from the agrarian past to our industrial past, it doesn't mean that there weren't any farmers anymore. When we moved from this sort of world where we had thick middle rings to one where we had thicker outer and inner rings and fewer township communities, we still have places where there are thick middle rings. And in fact, I think that there's a, one of the great hopes is that my family moved into a place, sounds like a little bit like the East Side, where everyone is still has garage sales and we have an annual cookout on the street and we all are getting to know one another. And we moved, you know, hundreds of miles away to find that. We wanted it, and I think it's very possible that future generations are going to have the same experience, that they want to know their neighbors. They want, once they have kids, to find communities just like that, and I think that's one of the reasons that we should be optimistic. But on the broader spectrum, even outside of the communities that have thick middle rings, I think that the experience most Americans have, and I think if you talk to a lot of people who compare the relationships they have today with the relationships that their parents maintained when they were adults or that their grandparents maintained when they were adults. Just think about that individually. Who are the people that received the bulk of your time and attention versus the people that your grandparents spent the bulk of their time and attention with? There's a big difference. And that it's that shift, which has lots of advantages, has the disadvantage of making it so that our experience talking to one another across chasms of political ideology has been diminished, so that and has polarized our politics.
We have lots of callers, and I'll get to more in just a moment. But we probably should talk about why you're optimistic or how this is going to change. Do we have to wait for everybody to move to you know, this type of neighborhood, or? What do you suspect that people are going to start holding more garage sales? Why are you optimistic about this?
Well, there are a number of reasons. One is it seems possible, as I just said, that people will come back to these communities, to this form of township community that is so quintessentially American. The second is we will, over time, I think, begin to develop ways to compensate for the fact that our politics is polarized. You know, before the Great Depression, government in the United States didn't provide nearly the social safety net that it provides today because businesses stepped up. They were the ones. The Great Depression hit. Suddenly, people couldn't depend on their employers and on charitable giving as much, and they turned to the government. But now if the government is going to is too polarized to respond in some cases, though in other cases it's not. I mean, I think the Affordable Care Act is evidence that things are turning around in many cases. In those cases, I think that we'll find nonprofits and community organizations that step in and fill the breach. In terms of, let me turn back to your original question, Joy. The issue is, what should we do now? And I think there are two things to do to try to help people rebuild these middle ring type relationships. The first is, I think that we need to give people opportunities to meet people who come from different points of view. One of the best ways, to my mind, to do that is to really vastly expand AmeriCorps, right? If you look at these city year volunteers who spend 18 months volunteering in a community, we think, most of us who look at it from the outside, these young people are doing something great for the place where they are. But the auxiliary benefit is they are spending 18 months with people who they don't know, who come from different parts of the country, from different types of communities, and they're building real bonds between one another, bonds that would make it so that someone who comes from a very conservative part of the country and someone who would comes from a very progressive part of the country would actually talk and begin to understand where the other is coming from in a way that isn't vitriolic, that isn't sort of the kind of conversation you would find on Crossfire. And the second is, what motivates people to reach out to people, to neighbors or to colleagues who have different points of view? There's a whole field of scholarship that's emerging that I look at more thoroughly in my book that comes around the term grit, which is the ability to withstand the impulse to walk away or to lash out at someone. What is it that makes it so that someone says, this is what I think about Governor Walker's proposal, or this is what I think about the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, or this is what I think about what's happening in immigration, and wants to have a civil and thoughtful conversation about it? And it turns out that this idea of grit or self-control is really the most determinative factor in whether someone has a long, successful, healthy life, that it is twice as powerful in determining a kid's GPA as their IQ, that it is this, it's this crucial element. Some people call them non-cognitive skills. Some people call it emotional intelligence. But some people call it character. The crucial issue is, what can we do in our schools and in our communities and in our lives to imbue future generations with more grit so that they are more inclined to reach out and bridge these connections between people who have different points of view?
I love that. Well, we do try to provide different points of view on Wisconsin Public Radio and try to be civil, so maybe that can be part of the curriculum. We will talk with Mark Dunkelman, author of The Vanishing Neighbor, The Transformation of American Community, in just a few minutes, and welcome more of your calls at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network. Our guest this hour is Mark Dunkelman. He is a research fellow at Brown University. He's a senior fellow at the Clinton Foundation. He is the author of The Vanishing Neighbor, The Transformation of American Community, talking about how the changes in our communities, in our relationships with others, are leading toward the polarization that we see today, talking about why this is and what we can do about it. And welcoming your thoughts and questions. We have so many. Let's go to Carol in Muscadet next. Hello, Carol.
Hi. I'm in the process of moving from one neighborhood in Wisconsin to a very different neighborhood in Minnesota. And you may in your book, Mr. Dunkelman, go into a lot of details about the different subcultures, but it sounds as if you're ascribing almost everything to this one factor among many factors of social change that have occurred over the period of time that you're talking about. And right now, in my experience, there are subcultures that are completely different. The contrast between what I'm moving to is unreal. My neighbors came up to me when I first moved in to the St. Paul neighborhood and introduced themselves and said, and this is all my neighbors. I mean, I'm talking six sets of neighbors came to my house, introduced themselves and said, if we can help you, let us know. And we were glad to meet you and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, it was just dumbfounding. I didn't know what to make of it. So, I mean, it was wonderful. So I know that there are neighborhoods out there that are very different from the ones that you're describing. They're in pockets. And, you know, this is something that is a kind of model. It has to do with the layout of the streets, as somebody mentioned.
Right.
It's a Jane Jacobs thing, you know. Anyway.
Well, I'm sorry, Carol, you're in Muscadet and you're moving to St. Paul. Is that what you're saying? In St. Paul, people are kind and giving and you're getting to know them already. And in Muscadet, it was not like that.
No, I'm not saying it's different culture. It's just a whole different kind of culture in so many ways that it's like a different country. So, and I'm not just talking Muscadet. I'm thinking of a lot of Wisconsin, communities and so on. But, and politically it's very different too. I've got to say that. It's a very liberal, progressive community. And people help each other and they're in each other's yards. They're giving me eggs from their chickens in their backyard, all this wonderful, idyllic stuff that I did not expect because I'm so used to this picture that you're drawing in your book of communities today. So I think that there's a lot of, there are pockets out there, and this is not a wealthy area. It's very diverse. I think the diversity makes such a difference.
Well, what do you think of that, Mark?
Well, it makes me want to move to St. Paul. I think there's a lot to be said for that observation. I don't think that this is a monolithic change entirely. I think that there are still pockets of places that have thick middle rings. And the idea that the caller is absolutely right that I think I went through, and if she does look at the book, she'll see that the first third goes through the whole host of changes that have affected American life over the last several decades, from suburbanization to digitalization to the fact that there are many more women in the workforce, the whole variety of shifts in the way we look at gay marriage. I mean, just the whole range. And what I've concluded is that this whole panoply of changes have compelled many, many Americans in many, many communities to be more insular. And that's the root cause of the shift in what's happening in our politics. That said, someone said to me at one point in the course of my research, it'd be interesting to look at which communities in America have thicker middle rings and which ones have thicker outer and inner rings. And what are the differences between the communities? Are there some that are more innovative? Are there some that are more friendly? Are there others where folks are healthier? And if I have a chance to write a second book and I could find good evidence on that, or just travel the country and look and try to make observations, I think that would be fascinating to do, because I do think the caller's right that I don't want to paint this with such a broad brush that I'm saying that every community is the same and that no one has middle rings anymore. But what is, I think, in the aggregate true is that we're spending much more time talking to people who we're very close with and people that we know only across the span of one issue of common interest. Yes. And that these people who we know who are familiar but not intimate are in many cases, in many communities, disappearing from our lives. And I think there's a generational element as well, that people who are older and who lived through the 50s and the 60s and the 70s remember a norm of American social architecture where people have these relationships, and people that are younger don't.
I want to talk about a little bit about the outer rings, because we haven't really talked a whole lot about that. Mary emails, I think that in the age of social media, people have become much less private about their political beliefs. They blast them all over their Facebook page or Twitter and make their points in a very polarizing way. Talk a little bit about that outer ring and how that's transforming our society.
Yeah, and Joy, I want to be very careful not to say that these outer ring connections or the inner ring connections are bad in any way. I think they're just different. On the outer rings, we've got all these opportunities to connect with people on issues that are really of interest to you and to me, We're both interested in whatever it is, if it's progressive politics or the Occupy movement, or it's conservative politics and the Tea Party movement, or it's we're both really into vintage Corvettes. Whatever it is, we now have all these opportunities to connect with these people only about those issues, right? We can follow their Twitter feed, or we can read their blog, or whatever it is. And that's taking up more of our time and attention. And there's nothing wrong with that. In many cases, it's a blessing. We want cancer researchers in Asia and in South America to be able to be in touch in real time about whatever it is, about the new discovery they made or the new data they found. And also, we want to be in touch if we are a crochet enthusiast and we've got a question about how to do a new design. We want to be able to find people all, no matter where they live. If they don't live next door, we want to have access to these folks. And that's great. The question is, what's the trade-off? And the trade-off, in my view, and this is the argument that I'm making, is that because we're spending more time with these people who have a very particular interest in common with us, we're spending less time with people who have who we know across a whole span of different issues, where they work, what they do, where their kids go to school, mm-hmm. what they like to eat, all these things put together.
I guess I'm thinking, too, though, on something like Facebook, you can be friends with neighbors and old high school buddies, and you can be friends with the mailman if you want to. And do you see a solution there where maybe we're becoming more tolerant of people of different points of views, more of these acquaintances and even strangers if we broaden our social networks?
So there is conflicting evidence about what happens, particularly on Facebook. There's a lot of evidence that shows that people who express points of view politically on Facebook are people who see that they have a friend on Facebook who has expressed a particular point of view that they disagree with tend to hide the profile or defriend
the
person. They don't want to be exposed. And the issue really is, I mean, you can put up pictures on Facebook or a thought or this. The issue is that there are ties that happen in the conversation had between two people waiting for their bowling game to begin. Or waiting for their hot dog to cook at a cookout, or waiting in the dentist's office. That there are conversations that personalize people, give them a broader sense of who they are and where they're coming from that don't come across in social media.
Yeah. Well, I guess we don't have time for another caller, but I don't. So, how optimistic are you? Do you see your change is happening?
Well, I am optimistic. I mean, I think that the American story is unique in that we've had this core social architecture for more than 200 years, and it has distinguished us from societies around the globe. I think that in the end, Americans will figure out a way to compensate for the loss of these middle rings. Either they'll be reconstituted because our children will just desperately want to know their neighbors, or we'll find that there are social organizations and nonprofits that fill in for the places where the middle rings have frayed. I think we're going to see over the course of the next several years and decades real advances made in how to imbue future generations with more grit. So I think there's a lot to look forward to, and I'm hopeful.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Mark Dunkelman, research fellow at Brown University, senior fellow at the Clinton Foundation, author of The Vanishing Neighbor, The Transformation of American Community. Thanks to Christy Taylor and to Justin Williams for producing and directing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I hope you join us tomorrow at this time. We'll talk about the journeys of our author and his dog, Casey. That's tomorrow at this time.